And for you, I hope.
Thank you very much. Welcome back.
Sylvia. Because I called Linda, and Linda said Jackie.
Yes,
until I called Linda last night.
I saw her at Yelma Shore.
I don't know if Sylvia knows that.
Well,
I
forgot to call her. I didn't think to call her.
Thank you for calling.
Well, we haven't met for so many weeks.
Right, but.
When I called her,
she
said,
"Was she there yesterday?" We didn't know when it was.
No, I saw Linda.
I called her.
I know.
Maybe she's not in
small. I
didn't
see
Sylvia
there.
I didn't see you. I saw Ethan.
It'll be online. It's always online. And Mirza Shem will come and join us. Today we're going to do a little bit of an introduction in all cases. We are starting Sefer Shmuel.
Oh, I don't.
It's 325.
325. Okay. 325. Before we start the Sefer, and we'll see how far we get in the introduction in terms of what I wanted to do, and I think I did this a little bit, we discussed this a little bit when we started Sefer Shoftim, but that was 4 years ago. So
I thought we were having a party.
We really should have. We still should. We didn't have a Siyum. 4 year project. It was too close. We could have had a Pesach Siyum, but who wants a Pesach Siyum? You pass one of those to each person. Don't mind. Just take one and pass them down. This is a small chart. I think I may have shared this with you once before. I used this chart, number one, because I think it's important to have a picture of what Tanakh looks like. From a bird's eye view. I also use this chart because one of the things that I do in my opening class in Tanakh at the girls' school with my high school students, which I'm not going to do here, but that's just because I don't give you tests. But I at some point or another insist that they memorize the order of the 24 books of Tanakh, and they get tested on it.
It's good to
watch. Now, excuse me?
Is there a
Namana or something? Well, so it's really very easy. It's really very easy. You just have to know certain secrets.
But the older you get, the harder it is to memorize.
Well, that's why the secrets are really important. That's why the secrets are really important. So I don't. So let's. If you go, we go through this. That's why I put this structure and the numbers together. When we talk about 24 books of Tanakh or Chavtal and Sifrei Tanakh, so of course the easiest way to divide them, Tanakh divides easily into three parts. That's the easiest division to remember, right? Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim. There's a lot of discussion as to what is included in. There's a lot of discussion as to what's included in Nevi'im and what's included in Ketuvim, how that distinction separates. Leaving that aside for a moment, the first five is a giveaway, right? So the first five you've got. You don't need to memorize the first five. That's an easy one. Yeah. So we're now down to 19.
Much easier.
Piece of cake. Right? And the next group is Nevi'im, and Nevi'im is divided up into 8 books, of which we traditionally separate those 8 books into 2 groups of 4. By the term?
Rishonim and Achronim?
Right. Nevi'im Rishonim and Nevi'im Achronim. Now, Nevi'im Rishonim and Nevi'im Achronim is a easy way to remember them, but it's a misnomer. Because what it sounds like is what would be the logical differentiation between Nevi'im Rishonim and Nevi'im Achronim by logic. Just think about it for a second. If I would intuitively, what would be the if I would say, okay, tell me what the distinction is between books that would be included in Nevi'im Rishonim versus books that would be included in Nevi'im Achronim. What would you think?
Timeline.
Right? You would assume the Nevi'im Rishonim are early and Nevi'im Achronim are later. And they're often referred to as early prophets and later prophets. That is probably the most mistaken way to divide Nevi'im Rishonim and Nevi'im Achronim. That's the way it's translated. It does not make a lot of sense. Because if you look at the 8 books that make up Nevi'im, what you'll see is that they have nothing to do with dividing them chronologically. The first 4 books of Nevi'im are Yehoshua, Shoftim, Shmuel Aleph and Bet, Melachim Aleph and Bet. So the first thing you'll tell me is, that's not four books, that's six. Right? Mm-hmm. So the first thing you say is, that's six books, not four. And the answer is, it's four books, not six. Why? They have the same name. So let's start from that question. Why does Shmuel Aleph and Shmuel Bet have the same name? Or why does Melachim Aleph and Melachim Bet have the same name?
That much I don't
know. So let's start with
it. It was divided up later.
Well, Melachim were all the kings. I mean, so.
Well, we're going to get to that question in a second, because that's not going to necessarily be so easy when you start to get to David and Shaul and David. And the question of why Sefer Shmuel is not included in Sefer Melachim, which is the basic question of today's shiur. But what is the relationship between Shmuel Aleph and Shmuel Bet, or between Melachim Aleph and Melachim Bet? Why do we have two books? When we count 24 books of Tanakh, we only count each one as one book.
Does it have anything to do with timing?
Which timing?
You know, the years.
The years of the substance of the subject of the book? No, but you're getting closer.
Timing of the events?
No, the timing of when they were published. And I don't mean by Tanakh. Let's start from the basic question. Who divides Tanakh up into chapters?
Didn't you say it was non-Jewish?
Right. The Christian publishers were the first to set chapter divisions to Tanakh. We traditionally had paragraph divisions in Tanakh, what we call parshiot. The Christians redivided what they call their old, we don't have an old and a new, so we only have one, but they essentially took Tanakh, what they call the Hebrew scripture or the Old Testament, and they redivided it by chapter. When they redivided it by chapter, they kind of equalized the size of the books. So they took the book of Shmuel, and they split it into two equal parts, give or take. They took the book of Melachim, and they split it, give or take, into two equal parts. The logical location of that division between, in the case of Kings, it's very easy to see that this is a completely illogical and absurd division. There's no rational, reasonable explanation whatsoever. It's a pure, arbitrary division of size. Because it splits right in the middle of a story of Eliyahu HaNavi.
So why do we follow the Goyim?
Oh, that's the question that Ramban has, and I'll share with you the answer in a second. But the division is clearly Christian in origin. Sefer Shmuel also is one book. And any reference that Chazal have to Sefer Shmuel is of one book. The division into two books, give or take 25, 30 chapters long each, is an arbitrary division of the Christians, and again it doesn't necessarily divide logically, because the death of Shaul is in the beginning, the end of Sefer Shmuel Aleph, and the mourning for Shaul of David's famous eulogy is in the beginning of Shmuel Bet. There's very little logic to that division. So when we look at Shmuel and we look at Melachim, we look at them as one book each, and we'll see that there's a few examples of that. Ezra and Nehemiah. Ezra and Nehemiah. We see Ezra and Nehemiah as one book. Traditionally, it was written as one book. For some reason, the Christians divided it into two books, one called Ezra and one called Nehemiah. But in the language of Chazal, it's one book called Sefer Ezra. And that is, so that's important to note. Similarly with Chronicles, Divrei Hayamim. We have a Divrei Hayamim Aleph, we have a Divrei Hayamim Bet. That is also an arbitrary division of the Christians. It has nothing to do with Jewish sources. And we have it, but Chazal, when they list 24 books of Tanakh, list these books as one. So,
the obvious...
When the Christian Bible was written, it was divided as such. When it became popularized, it was primarily in the Middle Ages. Why in the Middle Ages?
Printing press?
Before the printing press.
So, what century are we in? 13th?
Right now, the 21st.
<laughs> <laughs>
Well, the Christian Bible is written in the first century, the Common Era, the second century, and then the the question to answer your question as to why we maintained it, mm-hmm. right? That's the answer to your question as well, is because in the Middle Ages, 10th, 11th, 12th centuries of the Common Era, Jews were forced into public disputations with Christian theologians, with devastating consequences throughout Christian Europe. But in order to be able to function in the capacity of those public disputations with the Christians, we had to be able to refer and understand the chapter verse divisions of what they referred to as the Old Testament. It's our Tanakh, but they're dividing it differently than we traditionally had. So by virtue of the fact that we were engaged in a constant polemic for centuries with a Christian theological battle, we had no choice but to at some point or another understand and then adopt the chapter divisions that were introduced from a foreign source. And that's essentially how every Tanakh from that point forward was always divided, not only, and the current Tanakh is at least nice in the sense that it maintains both divisions, the original paragraph parsha division, which is the traditional division, as well as the contemporary or more well-known chapter, verse, book division that the Christians introduced.
So they're but, the only ones that do so?
Well, a lot of them do now, but it's one of the advantages. But the idea was that the division of the books of Tanakh, it's a complicated story, but we essentially have eight books of Nevi'im, not ten. The first four are referred to as Nevi'im Rishonim, and the latter four are referred to as Nevi'im Achronim. So if you put them down on the board, it comes out like this. Nevi'im Rishonim, Yeshua, Shoftim, Shmuel, Melachim. Okay? I'm going to put them parallel for a second. Nevi'im Achronim are also four books. Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel,
and Rash.
And Treyasar. Now, Treyasar is Aramaic for 12. Right. And Treyasar itself is a book made up of
the minor prophets.
Referred to as minor not because they are less significant in stature, but because they are
shorter books.
Smaller. And the reason they're put together into one, oh, we'll talk about that in a second.
Publishing.
Why? From Hashaya to Zechariah. Zechariah. Okay. So what divides these four from these four? What separates them into early prophets and later prophets by terminology? And I do not mean that they are chronologically early. Let's deal with the chronological issue. They're not chronologically earlier or later. How do I know that?
Because Malachim goes to the end of the same time as the Nevi'im, doesn't it?
Right. Because all of this, with the exception of
what's on the bottom?
Rabbi, isn't there a container right there?
It
no?
is, but there's nothing in there.
Oh. Okay.
Treyasar is divided up, starts with Hosea, all the way to Haggai, Zechariah, and Malach. Okay? 12 books. Yeshayahu lived when? Give or take. Contemporary to what book?
Malachim Aleph.
Malachim Bet. Give or take. Towards this latter half of Malachim Bet. Yirmiyahu?
Malachim Bet.
Lives through the Chorban. Malachim Bet. Yechezkel? He starts at the end of Malachim Bet through the Chorban, and then he goes further because he's the prophet during the time of the exile to Babel, so he carries them through contemporary to the books of Daniel and Daniel primarily. Treyasar? They're all in Malachim. There's no books in Nevi'im and Malachim Aleph. The only book of Nevuah in Malachim Aleph is the book of Eliyahu, and it's included in Sefer Malachim.
So what year are you up to here?
I'd need a timeline of Tanakh, but I'll schematically divide up the years for you in a second. But contemporary all to somewhere in the middle of Sefer Malachim. Treyasar is also, up until Chagai, is all kings that are contemporary to the end of Malachim. Correct?
Mm-hmm.
Chagai, Zechariah, and Malachi are the three prophets that accompany the return from Babel, Shivat Zios. So they're post Yechezkel, they're post Daniel, they're post Esther.
I put them out.
Okay? So if they are, they're separate. But essentially, all of Nevi'im Achron, what we call Nevi'im Achron, Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, nine out of 12 of Treyasar are all contemporary, at least overlap in part, with Sefer Malachim. It's hard to say that these are chronologically earlier than these. The first three are, but Malachim certainly is not. Right? Malachim is parallel. So what really divides these four from these four?
Well, these are traditionally what we call the Nevi'im.
We finished them. We've done there. That's that. We're not. There's no need to get back.
Traditionally, the Nevi'im, aren't they? The one.
They're books of Nevi'im?
Yeah.
These are books written by Nevi'im.
Okay, well.
What divides them in style, nature, subject matter, content, focus?
This is more historical, right? Isn't it?
Right. This is your narrative of Tanakh history. Now, the narrative of Tanakh history is written by Nevi'im. We're going to look at that in a few moments. The narrative of Tanakh history is written by Nevi'im. Hmm. But there's a difference between the narrative written by Nevi'im and these books. Why?
Because these actually have the prophecy.
For example, let's take Yirmiyahu for a minute. Yirmiyahu is the author of Sefer Malachim. So why does he write two books?
Maybe he didn't want to go that hill.
So, to some extent, you have to understand the difference in character of these two books. If this is narrative, this is storyline, this is essentially the events as they unfold, the history of Tanakh. What are these?
The chapters.
Poetry.
The direct Nevuah from
Hashem. The Nevuot themselves, the Nevuot, the messages that the Nevi'im articulated. In other words, these books, Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, Treyasar, for the most part, are a collection of, let's give it a contemporary title, famous speeches. Famous speeches of Yeshayahu, famous speeches of Yirmiyahu, famous speeches of Yechezkel. Go read the book of famous speeches of Abraham Lincoln and try to recreate the story of Abraham Lincoln's life. Right. You can't do that. Why? Because you can't do it without the narrative, the storyline. So here are your speeches. They have to fit into your storyline. It's very hard to learn Yeshayahu without learning Sefer Malachim at the same time.
And everything points to Malachim anyway.
Well, it's because... please God, we'll get to Sefer Malachim eventually. We'll, we should only live to be
right.
But that is so why do we call them one set Nevi'im Rishonim and one set Nevi'im Achronim? You're gonna hate this answer.
Because you need the storyline before you understand the Nevi'im or no?
You're gonna hate this answer.
There has to be a way to divide them up.
Because it's really unsatisfying. But it really is the truth. Sometimes unsatisfying answers are really the simplest. Because in the listing of Tanakh, these four come before these four. So these are Rishon, and these are Acharon.
The
I told you it would be an unsatisfying answer, but that's really the answer.
You mean so it was an arbitrary listing of the way it
it's
went?
It's not arbitrary. I mean, it's listed first, the book's the narrative of history. These are the first books of the historical narrative of Tanakh. So that comes first, followed by the speeches books that were written by the Nevi'im that are just listed afterwards. So Nevi'im, the books of Nevi'im are divided into two sets. The first four of the narrative, Yeshua, Shoftim, Shmuel, Malachim. And then the Nevuot of Yishayahu, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, Tirasa. Within each set, they're chronological. So this is a with exception of Tresa, which is a collection of
back and
books.
Forth.
And why are Tresa all put together into one set?
Shorter,
and therefore?
They fit into one book.
You wanted a simple answer, she gave it to you.
Sort of. It's sort of correct.
It's
missing one piece, which is that we don't have, which is that originally, till the 16th century, we didn't print books in books. We printed them, we wrote them in
scrolls.
Mm-hmm. Treyasar is essentially, each one of the books of Treyasar is a, were it to be a scroll by itself, would not be big enough to be a scroll. One column, two columns, four columns, maybe six if you're lucky, if you should. The longest one is Hosea. They're just not big enough. And they were afraid they'd get lost. A scroll like a Sefer Torah is big enough, it's not going to get lost. A scroll of Yeshayahu is big enough, it's not going to get lost. A scroll of Avadio, which is one chapter long, it's really one piece of parchment, is going to get lost.
We did lose things.
Right? So they took all of the 12 books, right? They took all of the 12 books of Tresa, and they wrote them into one scroll so that they would not get lost. Simple. That's the simple answer.
Who gave that label?
The commentaries referred to them in that fashion. There's no official title. It's not an official halachic, significant philosophical description. That's why I said it's an unsatisfying answer, because it's just it's a way of referring to them when we print them in Tanakhs. We print them Nevi'im Rishonim and Nevi'im Achronim. When we teach them in an educational environment, we teach Nevi'im Rishonim. Nevi'im Rishonim are easier to work with because they're narrative. Nevi'im Achronim are much harder. And they're harder for two reasons. Number one, the language is harder. And number two, because you can't learn speeches without learning the history. So you have to have a really good grasp of what's going on here before you can understand what's going on here. So to memorize the eight books of Nevi'im should not be that hard.
So I said to you, we're gonna
right
there.
Right? It shouldn't be too hard. The four books of Nevi'im, you could do that blindly. And the four books of Nevi'im Rishonim is the history line. Yeshua, Shoftim, Shmuel, and Malachim. And you don't have to worry about Aleph and Bet because
they're gone.
Right? We don't care about Aleph and Bet. They're gone. Not our issue. So that is the story of Nevi'im. Timeline-wise, you asked the question of timeline. Give or take, from the time we enter into the land of Israel, Yeshua is approximately 20 years in length. Shoftim, you tell me.
400.
Give or take 400, 350 to 400. Shmuel, huge debate. David HaMelech's reign is 40 years. Shmuel's life, from birth to the end of his life, and Shaul's reign. But Shaul's reign is fraught with controversy as to how long he reigns for. So, give or take?
100 years.
Excuse me?
100 years.
Maybe. 100 years. What we do know is a fixed point. And the fixed point is the beginning of Sefer Malachim Perek Vav, which is the building of the Beit HaMikdash. The building of the Beit HaMikdash, which takes place in year 4 of Shlomo HaMelech, that is referenced specifically as year 480 from Yetziat Mitzrayim, which is 440 from Yehoshua's entrance into the land of Israel. So we can
specifically say that from the beginning of Yeshua until the fourth year of Sefer Melachim is 440 years.
It's pretty interesting.
Right, that's our fixed point. And then from the building of the Beit HaMikdash until its end is about 410 years, depending on how you divide it up. Let's say 410 years. So the whole biblical era till the destruction, from the entrance of Yeshua until the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, is about 850 years, give or take. There may be some missing years and overlap, but essentially that's that. Okay.
Considering how long we've been in Gauls.
That's what we typically say about 1,000 years for the period of the Jews in the land of Israel before the destruction. It's a little bit less. It's about 850. Okay. Which brings us to
Ketuvim.
That's where life gets tricky. So now we've got 5 books of the Torah and 8 books of Nevi'im. Not hard to
memorize.
Torah Nevi'im, Vayishmael Shmuel Yikubim Advarim, Yeshua Shavtim Malachim Shmuel Yeshayahu Yemiyahu Yechezkel Tversai. Just do it in sets. You with me? Ketuvim. Ketuvim gets really interesting. Ketuvim also divide and conquer. It's my philosophy on life. Divide it up into smaller units and makes it easier to work with. So Ketuvim is divided up into 3 sets of books. The first 3, which we're going to define by characteristic, are Tehillim, Mishlei, and Iyov. Tehillim, Mishlei, and Iyov. Oops. Mishlei and Iyov. The next group, which is 5 books, are Shir HaShirim. Shir HaShirim, Rut, Echa, Kohelet, Esther. And the last 3 are Daniel,
Ezra
/ Nehemiah, back to that old issue, and Divrei HaYamim, Aleph and Bet. Okay. How do I remember them? And in sequence. Simple. There are 3 sets of books that define Ketuvim. The first set are all works of philosophical nature. Tehillim, Proverbs, Iyov, and the famous Job story of reward and punishment. They're all books in which we are philosophically searching for an understanding of the world. Correct? Typically, when we search for an understanding of the world, we have a classic terminology for that. We call it searching for the...
Truth.
Say it louder.
Truth.
Truth. Truth in Hebrew is referred to as...
Emet.
Aleph, Mem, Tav. They are traditionally referred to as Sifrei Emet. Except that truth is always elusive, and therefore it's backwards.
Cute.
That's what that's how I teach the students at Blogger. Sifrei Emet backwards. Tehillim, Mishlei, Iyov. First 3 books of Ketuvim. Once you've got that, the rest are easy. Why is the rest easy? Okay, the 5 Megillot. Now, the 5 Megillot are completely out of chronological sequence. There is no chronological sequence of the 5 Megillot whatsoever. They are, in the Gemara refers to them in chronological sequence, but we have them printed in Tanakh in a very odd sequence. Anybody tell me what it is?
It's on the calendar.
When holidays come?
Right. Based on the calendar and how the sequence in which they are read, starting with
Pesach.
That
should be in the calendar.
Pesach, Shavuos, Tisha B'Av, Sukkot, Purim.
Wow, that's pretty easy.
It only makes sense if you're after the custom to read them at different times of the year. In the time of Chazal, they didn't have such a custom. So in the time of the Gemara,
it makes
sense for us. In the time of the Gemara, they're printed in chronological order. We don't, because we printed them in order of the way we read them after the custom to read them in various Chagim. The only one that Chazal had a custom to read was Eicha.
Yeah.
That's why the only one we make a bracha of.
So who made the custom that we read these?
That developed over years. That developed over time. There's no, it's not halachic mandated. It became a custom. Oh, it is today, but it became a custom many years later.
The famous story of Rabbi Akiva and Moshe Rabbeinu, the Beit Midrash.
Well, that was a different issue. That was Torah Shabbat Per issues. But this was really, these were really custom. That's why we don't make a bracha over it, because it's not a takanat chazal. Chazal didn't institute the reading of time of the Gemara. Only one the chazal instituted and mandated was Esther. The rest of them developed over time. But that's the sequence. The sequence, you start with Shir Hashirim and you just work off the calendar.
That's cool.
Okay? What you're left with are really the only three you have to memorize. Sorry. And those are the books of what defines them? Characteristic?
Don't
know. Leftover? No, not leftover. They do have a theme in common.
Aren't we back to history again?
Yes, we are back to history again, but we're in Ketuvim because we're post-Nevuah.
We're not post-Churban.
No, we are post-Churban.
Well,
Divrei Hayamim starts at the chronicle of Tanakh, but it really goes up to Shivat Zion. It's written by Ezra. So essentially, these are the books of Galut, Bavel, and Shivat Zion. And Daniel is written by Daniel, Ezra and Nehemiah is written by Ezra and Nehemiah, and Divrei Hayamim is written by Ezra. So they really chronicle the return of the Jews from the Babylonian exile, post the Churban, or post-Babylonian exile, I should say, and there is no real shortcut to remembering them other than the fact that they are books of Shivat Zion. So Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Divayim. So now your 24 books of Tanakh should be
easy.
Don't test them.
But yeah, give or take, you should be able to. If you give it some thought, you should be able to put it together. It's just it's not as complicated as it looks. If when you look at a page and there are 24 books in Hebrew, 24 names of books in Hebrew on the page, and you say, now what do I do? Right. That's not as complicated. So Treyasar is complicated. There's no shortcut that I know of to Treyasar. Learning Treyasar, the order of the books of Treyasar by heart, other than to learn them in depth in parallel to the Book of Kings and know where they come and what they say. And
All my years of teaching Tanakh,
I've never been able to memorize the sequence of Treyasar, so that's all right.
Chronological order.
They're in more or less. Depending on when they lived, some of them are under dispute as to when they lived.
Like Yonah.
All right.
Rabbi, why did you want to start with this before we get into Shmuel?
Oh, thank you. That's the segue I was waiting for. Thanks very much.
Was that a plant?
I did say I would come back to an issue. The truth is, there's two reasons. Number one, because I start with this before I start any Sefer Tanakh. We did this when we did Yoshua, and we did this when we did Shoftim, and we do this now when we do Shmuel. Start a Sefer Tanakh, it's important to know where it is.
You put all those names on, explained to us about Emmet and everything before.
I do not remember it. And I was here for Yeshua and for Yoshua.
That's what I want to know.
We went through it, but I don't know if we did.
We may not have done the table.
But you went through.
At least I can say that I never saw it before.
Maybe. I'll grant maybe we didn't do it in as much depth. However, the question that I... The reason, say, for Shmuel, it's particularly important because it raises the question of what the logic is in the division between the four books in Nevi'im Rishonim. Nevi'im Rishonim by itself, Yeshua, Shoftim, Shmuel, and Malachim, raises this question. Leaving Shmuel out of the picture for a second, because that's going to be the hardest one to figure out, looking at just Yeshua, Shoftim, and Malachim, I have to ask you the question, what makes them each a separate book? What defines the uniqueness of each one to be, forgetting Shmuel for a second, why is Yeshua, Shoftim, and Malachim three different books?
Yeshua is conquering the land. Uh, Shoftim is not, there was no king in Israel and everybody did what they wanted, so it's the era that
that's only the last six, four chapters.
Yeah, but
chapters.
It's the era in which they probably needed a king, didn't have one, and how they cope with it. Malachim is the kings.
Okay.
We got a lot of wars in all those.
That's true. There's a lot of wars in all of them.
Yeah, that's
a lot of wars in
these books.
Yeah, that's
war.
Okay. They are all chronological.
Yeah, that's yeah. But I mean, but why are they divide? But what he's asking is why
right.
are they divided that way?
Get Shmuel for a second. Take Shmuel out of the picture. Why separate Yeshua from Shoftim and Shoftim from Malachim? Why not just with one book of one long story of Tanakh?
We'll call it
Nevi'im. Call it Torah.
The scroll would be too big.
Right? It wouldn't be bigger than a Sefer Torah.
That's true.
Think about it from the perspective of the name of the Sefer. So let's start with the simple. What's the basic theme of Sefer Yehoshua from start to finish?
The story of Yehoshua conquering the land.
The story of Yehoshua conquering the land. Right?
Mm-hmm.
What's the basic story of Sefer Shoftim? Forget the last four chapters for a second, because
right.
that's a sort of a commentary on the rest of the book. Let's go back to the rest of the book. It's the basic structure, storyline of Sefer Shoftim.
Trying to keep the people together, the B'nai Yisrael together, as with some sort of unity.
Why is it called Sefer Shoftim?
Because that's who the leaders were.
Because the leadership of Israel was defined by the institution called the
Shofet. That's the difference, who the leader is.
Why is Sefer Malachim called Sefer Malachim?
Because
they're Malachim.
There
you go. Okay? The leadership of Israel is defined. The books seem to divide up neatly by, supposedly, we're going to see the problem in a second, neatly by the leadership of Israel. Yehoshua, it's one book with one leader. So it's not, whether you call him a king or a shofet is irrelevant. He's one leader, it's one person. Like we call Torah, Torat Moshe. Yehoshua, Sefer Yehoshua. Shoftim is the story of the institution of leadership called the Shofet. There were many different Shoftim, and we can talk about the difference between a Shofet and a Melech, but essentially it's a chronicle of the success and or failure of the leadership role, but it was a definition of Shofet, or position of Shofet. And then we get to Melachim, which is
the institution of the kingship.
Right?
So what do we do with
the institution of the kings? Here's where the problem gets dicey. This is a very neat division, but it falls flat on its face in Sefer Shmuel. Why does it fall flat on its face in Sefer Shmuel?
Because Shmuel is a Shofet.
So first of all,
he's not alive the whole book.
Yeah.
Sefer Shmuel, and we'll get to the authorship in a second, but there are four major personalities that will take us through Sefer Shmuel from beginning to end. Four major personalities. They are
Shmuel.
Okay, we'll start with the second.
David.
No, Shaul.
Shaul.
Well, I just want to do it in order, but that's Shaul.
Shaul.
Eli.
Right.
If we want to talk about leadership, there are four major leadership roles in Sefer Shmuel. Eli, Shmuel, Shaul, and David. Agreed?
Mm-hmm. So your conclusion
what do you do with
should be
what
that
you
Shmuel
have?
Must have been the most important, because why would it be named?
Well, clearly, well, maybe, but I don't think so.
Maybe live long.
Right? So we have essentially two institutions of leadership that we know of so far.
Mm-hmm.
Shofet and Melech.
Yeah.
So if Sefer Shoftim, and I challenge this assertion, but if Sefer Shoftim is, as we traditionally understand it, simply a transition between Shofet and Melech. What's the problem here? What is Eli?
He's a Kohen.
Okay, so Eli is a Kohen, but he's more than a Kohen. Take a look at Sef Perek Dalet Pasuk Yud Chet. Perek Dalet Pasuk Yud Chet. death of Eli, the very end of Eli's life, after he dies, when he hears about the death of his two sons, Hophni and Pinchas, he hears about the capture of the Aron, and at the fall of Shiloh, he dies. Perek Dalet, Pasuk Yud Chet. The end of the Pasuk reads,
Hu shafat et Yisrael
arba'im shana. That's a phrase that's very familiar to us. Right? That's actually a fallback to the early days of Sefer Shoftim, where you had a shofet for an entire generation. But Vu shafat et Yisrael is not a description of him being the Kohen, it's a description of him being a
shofet.
So he may have been the Kohen, but he was also a shofet.
So is Shmuel.
Now, so is Shmuel. Shmuel also, in a sense, has a dual role. Shmuel is certainly Shmuel HaNavi. And he's referred to as a Navi. He starts his career as a Navi. Take a look at Perek Gimel Pasuk Chaf. How does it? What does it say? Vayedak vayedakol Yisrael midan v'yad be'sheva ki ne'eman Shmuel l'navi la'Hashem. Shmuel was a navi. One place is called a chozer, one place is called a navi. But essentially, he's referred to as a navi. Not only is he referred to as a navi, but the description of him and of his rise to fame, and his rise to and his development of the loyalty of the people of Israel is because, starting with Pasuk Yitet, just look at these last three psukim of Perek Gimel. Vayigdal Shmuel v'Hashem haya imo. Shmuel grew up. God was with him. V'lo hipil mikol dvarav arza. He never got it wrong. He was a Navi with a perfect track record.
It's 328.
Right? Modern day Nevi'im don't have to have such a track record. Who are what are modern day Nevi'im? Modern day Nevi'im only need a 50% accuracy rate. Who are the modern day Nevi'im?
Why do they only need 50%?
Because they're meteorologists. And meteorologists only need 50% accuracy to stay in, to keep in their jobs. Right? That's modern day Nevi'im. Biblical Nevi'im, Biblical Nevi'im, they need 100% accuracy because they speak in the name of God, so it's a little different. Vayigdal Shmuel v'Hashem haya imo v'lo yipil mikol dvarav arza. Vayeda kol Yisrael midan v'yad b'sheva ki ne'eman Shmuel l'navi l'Hashem. Those two accolades, Navi and Ne'eman, the last time they were put together was by Moshe Rabbeinu. B'chol beiti ne'eman hu. That's high praise for a Navi. By Yosef Hashem leheira'o b'Shiloh, God appeared, God revealed himself to Shiloh, in Shiloh. Ki nigla Hashem o Shmuel b'Shiloh, God appeared, his opening relationship is defined as a Navi. So clearly his role is as a Navi. On the other hand, at the end of his sort of leadership tenure, not his life, but his leadership tenure before the beginning of the request for a king. Take a look at the end of Perek Zayin. Pasuk Tetvav. Tetvav. From verse 15. Vayishpot Shmuel et Yisrael, judged Israel, kol yimei chayav, his whole life, v'halach midei shana v'shana v'savav beit el v'agilgal v'amitzvah v'shafat et Yisrael et kol ha'makomot eile. He was an itinerant judge. He used to go from place to place. What do they call it, a circuit judge?
Yep.
Utshuvato haramata kisham beito. And then he would go home to Ramah, which was his hometown, v'sham shafat et Yisrael, v'yivin sham yisbeh. Certainly, although he was a Navi, but his functionality was as a shofet. Then we get to Perek Chet and Tet, which is the request for a king. And in the request for a king, all the whole story turns upside down.
good request, bad request, wanted, didn't want. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about the request for a melech, whether they needed a melech, didn't need a melech. All of Sefer Shmuel, all of Sefer Shoftim points to the desperate need for a melech. Sefer Shoftim was written by Shmuel, and then Shmuel gets angry at them for asking for a king. A mystery will need to resolve. But Shaul is
the first king.
Except that Shaul has a problem. He's got many problems. One of the problems is that the definition, one of the distinctions between a king and a shofet, not the only, but one of them, is that a king is a dynasty and a shofet is a single leader. Right? So when that dynasty is taken away from Shaul and given to David, what happens to Shaul?
He loses it.
Kingship.
He loses his mind. But besides that, what in status, what does he lose?
His kingship. Right?
He loses his kingship, so now what is it?
Nothing.
A king for one generation is what?
King for one generation.
No, king for one generation is a shofet.
Shofet.
Oh. But because it's not the time.
Right? So
he himself was the beginning of the dynasty. The
yeah, but I mean, he was anointed as a
melech. I mean, a dynasty of one.
Yeah, but he was anointed. But he was anointed, and shofet were
correct.
Anointed.
It's not a dynasty till the next generation.
It started with a dynasty. It starts somewhere.
Correct.
It started with him.
It started with Shaul,
and
then it was taken away from Shaul. So now, retroactively, he's
maybe
a shofet, not a melech.
But wasn't he anointed a king?
Why is David HaMelech not allowed to build the Beit HaMikdash?
That's
too much blood. That's not what it says.
Oh.
At least it's not what it says in Sefer Shmuel. One of the issues we're going to get to, it says so in Sefer Divrei Hayamim. It doesn't say anything like that in Sefer Shmuel. All it says in Sefer Shmuel is that you have to have a son sit on your throne before you can build the Mikdash. Because the Mikdash is a palace. The palace has to be a palace to God. A palace has to be built by a king. David is not a king until Shlomo sits on his throne. Until he has an heir. It can't be a dynasty of one. Or you're a shofet.
But isn't there a difference between Shaul and Hashem?
What's the difference between a shofet and a melech? A shofet is a single. A shofet is the leader of the armed forces. King is the leader of the armed forces. A shofet is a political leader. King is a political leader. A shofet's leadership is absolute. King's leadership is absolute. There's what's the job description differentiation between a shofet and a melech? None.
But I thought when we did Shoftim,
so Sefer Shoftim, we talked about the national versus
tribal.
Correct. Okay. It's a separate issue, I said. But one of the distinctions between them is between a shofet and a melech is
dynasty.
The technical dynasty. Distinction between them is a dynasty. When Gidon wanted to establish a dynasty, we shifted it back into the conversation about kings. When they came to Gidon and they said Moloch aleinu ata v'bincha o ben mincha, and he said no, ani lo amloch alechem, Hashem imloch alechem. Oh, suddenly they wanted king. What did they want Gidon to do? They wanted Gidon to appoint his son as a successor. The moment he appoints his son as a successor, technically he becomes the first king of Israel. Tribal or not tribal, you can have multiple kings in Israel over different regions. We had for many years.
So if he didn't have a son, there wouldn't be.
Right? So when Shaul's son is not given the throne,
yeah, what if he didn't have a son?
So you can have a son-in-law. But you have to have a dynasty that continues.
Okay.
So there is a point in time in which this first king of Israel is then transformed back into a shofet. And then we have the real first king of Israel, which is
David.
So to some extent, you could argue, that Sefer Shmuel is a struggle for the emergence of kingship. And that's true. There are those who suggest that Sefer Shmuel is separate from Shoftim and Melachim by virtue of the zeroing in on the focus of the struggle, the ongoing, the internal struggle, and it's not an easy process to transition from Shofet to Melach.
Does the whole population know this?
What do you mean the whole population knows this? Which population are you talking about?
The population... The Jewish population.
Today?
No, in that time, do they all understand between Shofet and, I mean, everybody understands this.
We don't understand
now.
what we're going through now.
No, we're gonna. That's true.
Yeah,
we don't understand that we're going through it. That's part of the conversation. When they come to Shofet, to Shmuel, and they ask for a king, we'll have to explore what it is that they're looking for in a melech that makes it different from a Shofet, from their perspective.
Right.
One of the questions we're going to have to look at. 100%. But the problem with this division, and it works to some extent, the problem with this division is that it really could have been done much neater. Really could have been done much neater. Because the story of Eli is the story of a Shofet. And therefore really belongs where?
In
Sefer Shoftim. Even the story of Shmuel is a Shofet. And served as a Shofet. At least Shaul served after the request for a king, so technically he's referred to as Shaul HaMelech. But Shmuel, for all intents and purposes, his role, his mandate, his mission was a Shofet. We're going to see that when we study the Tefillah of Chana, that she connects the story of Shmuel directly to the story of Shimsha. There's a direct correlation between Shmuel and the Shimsha. It begs the role of being in Sefer Shoftim. Shaul and David are the beginning of Malchus. Why start Sefer Malachim from Shlomo HaMelech? It would have been very easy to start Sefer Malachim from Shaul. And the story would have been Shoftim, the end of the period of Shoftim, and Malachim in the beginning of the establishment of kings. So the notion that Tanakh divides these four books up by leadership structure is only a partial answer. It's still missing an important piece. And so the Mefarshim struggle with the question right at the beginning of the Sefer, what defines the division of these four books, and in particular the focus is on Sefer Shmuel, because the other three are relatively easy to identify. There's also a timeline issue. Yehoshua is the conquest of Israel, so I understand why it's a focus on one leader. Sefer Shoftim is 400 years, give or take. Sefer Malachim is 400 years, give or take. Sefer Shmuel zeroes in to the detail, the minutiae of the life of Shmuel and the life of Shaul and the life of David and the conflict between the 50, 60 chapters on one generation, which is really unique in Tanakh. So the question that we need to explore, and we're going to spend, we have 15 minutes left. I just want to touch on this question at the beginning because I think it'll help us understand how we're going to look at the book as we go through. So there's several possibilities. I give you another source page. You have it? Did everybody get the second source page?
Yeah.
So that's what we're going to look at. The Gemara in Baba Batra is the first stop along the way. Is the theory? That's mine. There should be more. There's a pile of them right over there because they're I made 25 copies. So the first step along the way is to explore, Suzanne, your question: who wrote them, and maybe the authorship would separate them. So the Gemara in Baba Batra explores this question. It talks about the sequence of Nevi'im and the authorship of each book. So the Gemara says the following, Tanu Rabbanan, Sidran shel Nevi'im, Yeshua v'shoftim, Shmuel v'melachim, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, Yeshayahu, Shnei Masai. As I said earlier, Chazal had a different sequence of some of the books of Nevi'im. Not our subject for now. The Gemara addresses it. I'm going to leave that. But Yeshua, Shoftim, Shmuel, and Melachim, four books. Then the Gemara asks, Mi katvan, who wrote them? Moshe katav sifro, upashad bilam, ve'iyov. One theory, Moshe writes the five books of the Torah, and the story of Bilam. The story of Bilam has a separate status in the Gemara, because it's the only story in Chumash from the beginning of the birth, from the moment Abraham comes on the scene, it's the only story in Chumash which is told completely and in entirety from the vantage point of a foreign people. It's the only narrative in Tanakh, in Chumash, that is not happening within the context of the Jewish people. The conversation in Bilam and Balak, we don't even know about it. So it has its own status in Halach. And the book of Eov, there's a multiple opinion dispute as to who wrote Eov and when Eov lived. One opinion. Yeshua Katav Sifro. Yeshua wrote his book. His book referring to Yeshua. And Shmona Psukim Shebatorah, 8 verses in the Torah. What are the last 8 verses in the Torah? Why is Yeshua credited with the writing of the last 8 verses?
Because Moshe dies.
Because Moshe dies, and then there are 8 psukim left after the death of Moshe. Clearly, one opinion says Moshe could not have written them. Another opinion says Moshe wrote them
before he died.
Al pi nevuah. V'Shmuel katav sifro v'shoftim v'rut. Shmuel writes 3 books. His book, which is of course Sefer Shmuel, Shoftim, and Megillat Rut. Then Tehillim. Tehillim's complicated because there are 10 different authors to Tehillim, the primary one being David, and then the additional ones, which I'll skip for a moment. Skip down to the last paragraph in bold of that source. Shmuel Katav Sifro asks the Gemara, Voktiv Shmuel Met. It's very nice to say that Shmuel wrote his book, but Shmuel dies in chapter 25 of Shmuel Aleph. So, who wrote the last 5 chapters of Sefer Shmuel Aleph and all of Sefer Shmuel Bet? And remember, Chazal had it as one book. So, Shmuel dies about a third way into the book. So, it's very easy to say Shmuel wrote the book, but there's 2/3 of the Sefer, or at least half of the Sefer, post the death of Shmuel. So, the answer, says the Gemara, is, Daske Gad Chozev v'Natan Navi. I have 2 additional Nevi'im in Sefer Shmuel. We think of Shmuel as the only Navi at the time. Remember, Shmuel has 2 roles. He's a Shofet, but he's also a Navi. There are 3 Nevi'im that will accompany the story of Sefer Shmuel. They are Shmuel, Gad, and Natan.
Which God is this?
Yom David El Gad. Navi God. Immediately after Shmuel dies. Part of the reason why you have Nevi'im here is very important for us. There is, throughout the period of the kings, there are Nevi'im in Sefer Shoftim too. They're not mentioned very often, but there are moments where the Navi comes to the people, the Malach, the Navi comes to them, chastises them, scolds them, tells them what's going on. There are references to the Nevi'im, but they don't have an official role. There's no official Navi. Named Navi at that time. Whereas in the time of the kings, every king had a designated Navi. Not just a Navi, a designated Navi. So the beginning of every Sefer Nevi'im, especially Nevi'im Achronim, begins with a list of the kings they served. Because that was part of the role of a Navi. The role of a Navi was to be a kind of a more balance, perfect. Spiritual check and balance to the king. You couldn't have an institution of a Melech without an institution of a Navi. Now, Sefer Shmuel, Shmuel starts his life as a Shofet, but very quickly they ask for a king. Who's the king that they appoint?
Shaul.
Which king appoints Shaul?
Which
Navi appoints Shaul?
Shmuel.
Now, Shmuel also appoints David, correct? But for all intents and purposes, the moment Shmuel appoints Shaul, his story ends. Let me rephrase that. The moment Shmuel appoints David,
his story ends.
David also has Nevi'im, but David has different Nevi'im. Shmuel was the Navi to Shaul. Who was the Navi to David?
God and Natan.
God and Natan at different times in his life. So if I put one Sefer together called Sefer Shmuel, it's written by what time? Written by Shmuel. If it's the story of Shaul, that's the part written by Shmuel. If it's the story of David, that's the part written by God and
Natan.
Natan. They will not leave me alone today.
Turn it off.
Right? So that is the... So now, one of the ways of looking at these books is who wrote them. Yirmiyahu wrote Sefer Melachim. Yeshua wrote Sefer Yeshua. Shmuel wrote Sefer Shoftim. You could argue, okay, so Shoftim is a, Shmuel is a separate book by virtue of its authorship. But that doesn't work either. Because...
He didn't write it all.
He didn't write it all, and the same author wrote Sefer Shoftim.
A lot of mixing up here.
So it's a good try. It's a good try. And in part why the Gemara lists who wrote what book. But it still doesn't answer our question fully as to why this is a separate sefer. Now I'm going to share with you, I have six minutes left, share with you an alternative suggestion. Oh my goodness. The red does not work very well. And this scratches.
How about Kleenex?
You're looking for the eraser that has disappeared.
I don't know what happened to the eraser. I'm not... guess what? I remember that the red doesn't work well. This is not good.
Or maybe those like baby...
That's
ones.
Really not good. I don't want to scratch it. If I scratch it, I don't
know. It's like a dye. Mm-hmm.
Right, we'll just use the ink. The other possibility of looking at the books of Tanakh, which along the lines of what we said here. Similarly, we started with the suggestion that each one of these books defines a different institution of leadership. Shofet and Melech. We're missing two.
Kohen
and
Navi.
So when we look at Sefer, we look at Parshat Shoftim. I once showed this to you before. That if you look at Parshat Shoftim from Devarim Perek to Zion until the end of the Parsha, is one Parsha which lists all the institutions of national leadership in Israel. There are four. They are?
Kohen.
Shofet. Melech. Navi.
Why did I write it like that?
I'm sure you have a reason. Mishkan?
Mishkan, yeah.
Then with the cat.
Oh, good.
She plays Scrabble.
Okay. Now, that's an acronym, and it's a cute acronym. But beneath it is a very important message. And that is that in the way the Torah sets out the structure of leadership in Tanakh, all of your institutions of leadership, your melech or your shofet, or your kohen, or your navi, they all interact with each other. And they interact in a complex check and balance between political leadership and
religious.
Spiritual leadership.
They always get along?
No.
No. Would you like me to tell you who
question.
Always has the last word?
Yeah, rhetorical question.
But the... and the Mishkan essentially serves as the centerpiece around which the institutions of leadership revolve. That's why the camp in Israel in the Torah is defined with the Mishkan at the middle and then the Machne around it. So your institutions of leadership, your melech, your shofet, your kohen, they all have roles to play, and they're separate roles. The kohen is equivalent to a king. The kohen gadol wears a crown like a king. A melech wears a crown. But the domain of the melech and the domain of the kohen is separate. And the melech is not allowed to enter the domain of the kohen gadol. Kohen gadol is not allowed to enter the domain of the melech. The only one who can react and traverse both is the Navi, which will later be replaced by the Chachamim after the end of Nevuah.
because there's a role for the authority that determines law that is then the check on the melech and the Kohen Gadol. There is no system of absolute power in Torah. The melech has to carry around a Sefer Torah with him because he's subject to the authority of the law. The interpretation of the law is either through the Navi and later through the Chachamim. But the Navi cannot serve as the melech. Shmuel could be the Shafet, but he couldn't be the Melech. There's a very complex balance between them. The Navi serves, especially once you have a kingship, the Navi serves as a kind of controller or check on, spiritual check on the Melech. And they all revolve around the Mishkan. So let me ask you a different question.
This is very fascinating.
What is the status of the Mishkan in Sefer Yehoshua?
It's moving.
In Yehoshua, it moves once, but not particularly often. What is the status of the Mishkan in Sefer Yehoshua? Remember back to Yehoshua days? Way back when.
Something about... they had permission if they couldn't get that far to do Karbanot or the war.
So the Mishkan, in Sefer Yehoshua, the Mishkan starts in a place called Gilgal. That was base camp for the army of Israel. And every time they finished a campaign, they went back to base camp. Towards the middle of the Sefer, chapter 18, Yehoshua is very upset with them because they're not going out and settling the land. So he divides them up. And he breaks up the base camp at Gilgal. And he moves the Mishkan
to Shiloh.
So Sefer Yehoshua starts with the Mishkan in Gilgal as a national base camp for the army of Israel. It ends when Yehoshua sends them home. He sends them to the tribes. He sends them to the various locations. And in doing so, puts the Mishkan in Shiloh. Shofti. What's the status of the Mishkan in Shofti?
It's in
Shiloh. It's in Shiloh. How many times is it mentioned in Sefer Shofti?
Not a lot.
Right. So Shofti, in a sense, is, if I look at it from the vantage point of the status of the Mishkan, it's in Shiloh. It stands in Shiloh for 369 years. But it is neglected. But it is neglected. It is abandoned. Its role is relatively
minor, marginalized,
and unfortunately for Sefer Shoftim, part of the tragedy of Sefer Shoftim is that it is marginalized. We spent a good deal of time talking about why. We're going to see that again at the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, Chofni Pinchas. What's the status of the Mishkan in Sefer Shmuel?
Are they all going up there?
Only Eli.
Right.
Oh, and that's part of the opening chapters. Only that's, he attempts to take crowds. That's the opening chapter.
People don't go.
But it doesn't go past the opening chapter. What's the status of the Mishkan in the story of Sefer Shoftim as a whole?
Sefer Shmuel
as a whole.
It's destroyed.
It's destroyed in Perek Dalet. Meaning that the story of the beginning of Sefer Shmuel is the story of Eli's struggle to bring Jews to the Mishkan, his failed effort to do so, the story of Hannah, the birth of Shmuel, and ultimately the corruption of Shofni and Pinchas, the failed leadership of Eli, all of that leads to the destruction of Shiloh. So we go from Churban Shiloh
to the Mikdash.
Now, before we get to the Mikdash, let's go talk about the Mikdash. What's the first thing that David HaMelech does when he becomes king? Sorry, rephrase that. First thing that Shlomo HaMelech does when he becomes king.
He orders the building of the Mikdash.
He builds the Mikdash. correct? Mm-hmm. Why does he need to build the mikdash? And in order to build the mikdash, he has to move the Aron. He has to bring the Aron. What does he have to bring the Aron to? Yerushalayim.
Because
Shiloh's gone. There's 100 years between the Shiloh's gone and the building of the Beit HaMikdash. What's going on in those 100 years? That's the question. What's going on with the Mishkan in those 100 years?
I thought the Aron was destroyed
For
the
each team.
Aron was captured and then returned.
Right.
Chapter 5. It doesn't stay by the Plishtim for more than one chapter. The Aron can take care of itself.
Hiding.
It moves.
But it doesn't stay. But it doesn't come back to the Mishkan.
It moves around with
right? The Aron is. It doesn't go. The Aron is hidden. The Aron comes back and it's in a tragic story in Beit Shemesh, and they take the Aron, they hide it, they put it in Kiryat Yearim, and they say, you know what, this Aron is too dangerous for it to float around, and they put it somewhere in a good place for safekeeping and hiding until years later. David HaMelech will try to move the Aron from its place in hiding to Yerushalayim. When he changes to Yerushalayim, tragedy strikes again. And this we just read as a Haftorah. So David HaMelech again takes the Aron and he puts it in hiding. And he says, you know what, it's too dangerous. It can't function in this capacity. Puts it in hiding and leaves it. Until Shlomo HaMelech builds the Beit HaMikdash and brings the Aron to the Beit HaMikdash. So the Aron is in hiding. So what did they do with the Mishkan? Where did they put the Mishkan? The Mishkan is defined by a Mizbeach. Where's the Mizbeach? You know the answer to this.
No, it's not.
In Sefer Shmuel? No. Shlomo doesn't exist for all intents and purposes.
Was it with him? Doing the move with another?
No, he's in a place. So for example, through all the years of Shmuel, the Mizbeach was in a city called Nov. How do I know it's in a city called Nov?
Probably says that.
Because Shaul's one of Shaul's biggest crimes was the execution of the Kohanim in Nov when David sought to hide there. Nov Ir HaKohanim. Right. And from Nov it goes to Giv'on. In other words, what's the relationship between the Aron and the Mizbeach?
They're separated.
Right.
The what?
They're separated. Sefer Shmuel opens with the fall of the Mishkan and the separation of the Aron from the Mizbeach. Sefer Malachim opens with the restoration of the Aron to the Mizbeach. And the division of the Sefer isn't just a division of political leadership, it's a reflection of the status of the Mishkan Mikdash at the center of Jewish life. That's what divides the books. Yeshua, Mishkan and Shiloh. Mishkan in Gilgal. Shoftim, Mishkan in Shiloh. Shmuel, Mishkan in exile. Malachim, building of the Beit HaMikdash. And so your political leadership and your spiritual leadership, or your spiritual status of the Shechina and the Mikdash and the Aron and the Mizbeach, are all interconnected. As you go through the Sefer, the story isn't just about the kingship and the monarchy, the story is about the Mishkan, the Mizbeach, and the Aron.
We knew there was a logical answer.
Excuse me?
We knew there was a logical answer.